Today's episode of The Grave Talks is brought to you by Best Fiends. Download Best Fiends free today on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's friends without the R, Best Fiends. Today on The Grave Talks, Ghostland, a conversation with Colin Dickey. When Colin Dickey set out to write about American ghost stories and hauntings, he did not quite know what to expect. Through his research, he dove deep into some of the most storied haunted houses, asylums, prisons, and cities the United States has to offer. Along the way, he'd find true dark stories of a malevolent past, along with facts that sometimes simply did not line up with reality or history. Just how many of the infamous American haunted location stories are accurate, and how many have a tale to tell that is much darker than we ever imagined?
Well, right. I mean, I grew up in San Jose, California, so I grew up down the road from the Winchester Mystery House, which was a huge component of my last book, Ghostland, and American History and Haunted Places. And I think that probably my proximity to the Winchester Mystery House, that was one of the things that really started it, you know, sort of taking those tours as a kid, being in that crazy, wild Victorian house that seemed to go on forever and hearing those stories. The other cool thing about San Jose is the Rosicrucian Museum, which is this crazy Egyptology museum smack in the middle of the suburbs, which is another thing we used to take tours, like when we were, you know, it's, you know, school kids, we would take field trips there. And so those two kind of weird spaces, you know, Ghostland dealt with the Winchester Mystery House, and the Rosicrucian Museum ended up in this current book in sort of ways that I wasn't exactly expecting. But those were kind of the two kind of central poles of weirdness, I think, when I was a kid that drew me into that kind of stuff.
Did that interest continue throughout life? Was it something that kind of reemerged later, or have you always been kind of drawn into that world of ghosts and paranormal and things of that nature?
It probably faded. I mean, you know, when I was younger, I was really into Stephen King. I was really into horror and, you know, stuff like that. And then I kind of shifted focus a little bit. And so, I think it kind of faded. I think what happened was, you know, the very first book I wrote, which was about 11 years ago, which was on the sort of true story of how several famous people's heads were stolen in the early 19th century. Mozart, Beethoven, Franz Joseph Haydn, Emanuel Swedenborg all had their skulls stolen by mostly by phrenologists. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of went down this rabbit hole of like how and why phrenology, which is a completely bunk, bogus science, you know, nonetheless had a huge impact on the 19th century. And I think it brought me back to this question of, you know, just because something is fringe or, you know, isn't something that somebody that people take seriously, that doesn't mean it doesn't have an impact it doesn't leave a trace in our culture. And so I started to return to these things, you know, like ghosts and cryptids and stuff like that. Less so with an eye of like, you know, am I going to prove these exist, or, you know, conversely, am I going to, you know, debunk these once and for all? And more just like a question, like, how do these beliefs actually move through mainstream culture or popular culture in ways that we don't expect? And how do they actually, you know, influence and impact history in ways that we might not be expecting? So that's kind of how these things came together.
What has been your overall outlook on the world of ghosts and paranormal and things like that? When you got into creating and putting together the book Ghostland, where was your mindset in terms of belief in spirits and ghosts and things of that nature?
You know, I try to keep a pretty open mind. I don't know that I have ever had an experience that I, you know, could sort of conclusively say, you know, aha, this was a paranormal event. But I also wasn't, you know, necessarily ready to just, you know, dismiss the stories that I was told. And I think, you know, as I said, I mean, above all, I wanted to kind of gather these stories and see how they kind of move through the world. And, you know, through research, some things you find out, you know, okay, so that story that I've long believed to be true is actually not historically factual, but that doesn't necessarily mean, you know, ergo that, you know, a place isn't haunted or, you know, whatever, you know, but it may mean that those stories are worth looking at precisely because maybe they are, you know, distortions from the historical record. So I, you know, I try to be an active listener without, you know, impressing my own beliefs too forcefully onto what I was listening to.
Sure. Did you, I mean, it, not having had any experiences or so, as you expressed it, if I'm getting that right, up to that point in your life, was it something where you would say definitively, yes, I believe ghosts are out there, or no, that's impossible? There's always going to be some sort of explanation for something.
You know, I think it's just one of these things where I think, you know, like a lot of things, if somebody believes in ghosts, there's really not a thing you can say to them mm-hmm. that will dissuade them of a belief. And likewise, if somebody is a skeptic, then, you know, they are going to probably brush off any piece of evidence that you offer them. And so I think that I just found that kind of be not a really interesting or fruitful conversation to have, you know.
Sure.
So, you know, I thought that it was more interesting rather than to discuss, you know, my own belief, which, you know, I think is maybe personally just not all that interesting to me. You know, I was really interested much more into like these, you know, how a building came to sort of get the stories that, you know, it got attached to it, and who had those experiences and that kind of stuff. So I think that's where I ended up going with a lot of these.
That's what I really enjoyed about the book itself, is it's not just, oh, a ghost hunter goes into the building and then they had these experiences and how spooky. It's you get into the nitty gritty. You almost like, in some ways, it's like you take the fun out of the locations, but at the same point, it's factual. And for those of us who we're not out to debunk, but we just want to base opinions on facts and reality. And, you know, sometimes the lore of the buildings, it's fun, or the locations, it's fun, it's exciting, you know, it's things that you pass down, and if you're into kind of spooky stuff and atmospheres, you know, of course there's stories that are going to keep moving. But when you dig into it, as you did, and just as really, you know, anyone could, if they really wanted to do so, and find out the facts of some of these stories, be it the Winchester Mystery House or whatever it may be, so many of those things are very debunkable, for lack of a better term. And on our show, we don't sit here and debunk things, but in your book, you did a lot of essentially, you know, not necessarily debunking, but stating fact. You're just stating, here's what reality is, and here's what the lore is, or here's what people are still propagating to this day. Why do you think it is that people still cling essentially to some of these beliefs of ghosts and hauntings in some of these specific locations? I'm in no way saying all ghost stories are fake. I'm just saying some of these where the lore is Miss Winchester used X room in the Winchester house for seances and all that. And it turns out it was far from it. I believe it was like a maid's quarter or something. It really was nothing to do with summoning the dead and her living out certain days. These are just facts of where people were in time. But yet, no matter what, no matter how factual you can present these things, the world still sticks with their belief system of what they want to believe. Why is that? And we can go much deeper than that than just ghost stories, but it's a scary thing. I think even scarier than ghost stories, where people can still stick to a belief, even though it can be completely debunked. Back to the ghost stories in just a moment. First, I need to thank our supporter today, Best Fiends. Obviously, it's October, and I'm loving how everything gets all spooky, including Best Fiends. Yes, they got treats for you. Your favorite mobile puzzle game is packed with Halloween spirit. You won't want to miss the spooky levels, outfits, challenges. The Best Fiends has put it on all month. Just one more fun way to enjoy the spooky season. I've always used this as my mental palate cleanser. If I'm working on something around the house, if I'm working on shows here, if you just kind of, you know, you need a little break, a little time away from things, but you don't want to just stare and watch paint dry, my mind needs to be moving. I pick up Best Fiends on my phone and I play away, and I absolutely love it. It's been a great escape, especially there's so many stressors going on right now. Best Fiends is the infamously impossible to put down puzzle game that's free to install. Over 100 million downloads. The 5-star rated mobile puzzle game is a must play. There's more levels, events, and challenges that get added all the time. So play away. You're not going to get sick of it. There's always one more level. When you download this thing, boredom, it ain't got a single chance. We all love a good challenge, and Best Fiends, guess what? More than 5,000 challenges for you on this thing. More levels, events, challenges, they're added all the time, so it never gets old. It means you don't have to choose between binging and boredom. Check it out for yourself. Download Best Fiends free today on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's Friends without the R. Best Fiends.
Right. And, you know, I got to say, you know, I hope that the book or the books are still fun. I didn't set out to take the fun out of things. And I hope that didn't.
I find,
you know,
it
that's
fun.
Not the takeaway. But, you know, I guess what I would say is, you know, like when it, you know, and to stick with the Winchester House, I think that is such a beautiful and strange building. And I love being in that building. And even, you know, I mean, I grew up with these stories, and I thought the, you know, the story that she, you know, every night would summon spirits in these seances and they would dictate to her, you know, the construction of the house. And I thought that was, wow, that was crazy. You know, and the, you know, the idea that she was pursued by the spirits who had been killed by the Winchester rifle who were haunting her. I mean, these were the kind of stories that I set out. And I thought, mm-hmm. You know, I assumed them to be true when I started, you know, researching this project way back in, like, you know, 2010 or whatever.
Sure.
And almost immediately, I you know, because I'm trained somewhat as a historian, and so, you know, I know where to look for things, and it sort of blew my mind that these things just weren't there in the record as I assumed they would be. And, you know, one of the things about history is that we have much more complete records of people who are wealthy than we do of the poor, just because people are wealthy, they are literate, they have, you know, they keep diaries, the letters are preserved, these, you know, we just have more documentation from them. And so an immediately strange facet of Sarah Winchester's story is that here was somebody who was very wealthy about whom we had very little extant documentation. We didn't have a lot of letters or diaries or other things, and it was very strange to me. So, you know, so as I started to dig in and I, you know, read other sources and I found, you know, some of the few, you know, letters that were left around, and I started to understand that maybe the story I'd been told was not factually accurate. That to me was fun in a different kind of way, because I was basically like, well, you know, A, what is the real story? And B, how did this other story take on such a life of its own? And I think that is a really, for me anyways, and maybe not for all readers. I mean, maybe, you know, there are readers who just kind of want kind of the spooky story, and I get it. And I, you know, I go with God as far as, you know, I mean, I think there's nothing wrong with that, you know, but I think I wanted to tell a different kind of story, which was about how something like the Winchester House, because of its sort of anomalous design and it's sort of not like any other house anywhere in the country, kind of called out for explanations that, that began to be about things other than Sarah Winchester or things other than the house itself. And I think that is such a weird and cool, strange way of thinking about, you know, our relationship to the past and history. And that's kind of what I tried to do. So whether or not it's debunking to the point of being unfun, I don't know, but, you know, I hoped it was still entertaining.
I think maybe unfun is the wrong word. I think what I mean by that is, you know, the lore of some of the original stories that some of us have in our mind, you know, you've corrected that, but you've then replaced it with other stories that sometimes almost have a whole new chapter of mystique to them that maybe many of us didn't even know existed, you know, and it adds, you know, sometimes even more questions than answers. Maybe it doesn't even go down the ghostly route, but it makes you more curious about the history and the mindset of what was going on with some of these people in places at these times, for it to develop in certain ways that it did. When you're going through this and you're finding these historical facts that you weren't even aware of at the time until you started uncovering them, did you ever bring any of them up to the curators or the owners of any of these locations and say, okay, that story you just told me, good story, that's what I had heard forever, but here's what I found out factually? And I'm curious, if you did that, what kind of reaction you got?
Yeah, I mean, I've had different conversations with curators and you know, docents and stuff like that, and it runs the gamut. I mean, you know, a lot of these places, you know, not just the Winchester House, but particularly the Merchant's House Museum in Lower Manhattan, these are, you know, these are pretty imperiled sites. These are historical buildings that are on land that is worth, you know, gobs of money in rapidly gentrifying, you know, desirable areas. And thus, you know, developers are salivating for a reason to, you know, take a wrecking ball to these things. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that I think I found was that, you know, these stories, for better or for worse, they bring a new generation of people into these places. You know, the Merchant's House did not do ghost tours for many years until recently, even though there had been ghost stories circulating for decades. They just didn't really see it as part of their, you know, in sort of keeping with their image and their vision. But they have started to do ghost tours maybe within the last 10 or 20 years. And they found them to be very popular. And it's brought a new generation of people into the Merchant's House Museum, which again is a wonderfully beautiful, imperiled building that, you know, is a kind of jewel in Lower Manhattan that's under constant threat. And so I like the decisions that, you know, any sort of historical building makes in terms of how they want to open up their site to the public, I think is very specific and has a lot to do with, you know, the location and what they're kind of hoping to get with their, you know, with their public, as opposed to a place like the Stull Cemetery in Kansas, which has this reputation of being haunted. And it has led to a bunch of, drunken college kids who, get blitzed in the cemetery at night and end up knocking over tombstones and stuff like that. And Stull is very much not interested in any kind of paranormal reputation, precisely because they want people to be, you know, respectful of their cemetery and the lives that are buried there. So, you know, you really see it kind of run the gamut. And I think that that's a really fascinating, series of questions that a lot of different sites have to ask themselves.
Did you have a reaction from any of the locations that are in the book be like thankful that, hey, you're coming in and you're presenting the facts of these stories and these cases, because they're so sick of people coming in and going, I heard this or I read this. And they're like, well, actually, here's this, just in a more, just straightforward way, where there's finally a source that's out there on some of these locations beyond just Jim Bob's blog that is, you know, talking about the ghost of a location. But you're able to really spell out the true history of some of these places, you know, beyond the location's website.
Yeah, somewhat. I mean, I did an event at the Winchester House. I think that there was a kind of tacit understanding with the director that I talked to that, you know, both I wasn't necessarily wrong, but maybe they didn't have a whole lot of interest in redoing their particular version of events. And we sort of were fine with that.
I
don't know that I've had anybody sort of like, you know, be, you know, overly thankful, but because mm-hmm. again, I think that a lot of these places are very deliberate about how they control their narrative. And I think if they want a different kind of narrative out there, they're quite good at articulating that. And again, I think the Merchant's House is a great example of a place that has changed how they present themselves to the public, even within mm-hmm. the last decade or so.
Well, I mean, when you look at it, I mean, just paranormal tourism and such, obviously it's an industry. There's ways to make money. And sometimes the paranormal tourism is what keeps these buildings alive, you know, from being getting the wrecking ball into them, because they're finding a new purpose. And it's quite often it is tours, or it's letting investigators go in and do their thing. What did you run into any pushback at all from anybody, you know, saying, yeah, we kind of know that narrative is not true, but we still think there's other stuff going on here, and we're more hesitant on letting some of the facts of the cases come out while doing the research?
Yeah, I mean, as I said, you know, the Winchester people have the story that they want to tell, although they've been supportive of the book. And I don't know that they stock it in their gift store, but they had me out for reading there. And other places, you know, the Lemp Mansion, I think, you know, is another place that, again, has a story that they want to tell. And I personally don't always love the way that story gets told, because I think it that story in particular preys a little bit on mental health issues that I think maybe could be handled a little bit more respectfully. But again, sure. It's not it's not my building. It's not, you know, it's not really my place to say. So, you know, I tried to tell the story as best I could and leave it at that, I guess.
Sure. It's funny. I'll just throw a little antidote in there. There's obviously there is the real Lemp Mansion in the St. Louis area with all of the story behind it that, you know, and in your book, you spell it out beautifully of just, you know, here's historically what went on. And then there's also in that area, there's the Lemp Mansion haunted house, like Halloween-ish haunted house that gets put on every October in Halloween season. And the funny thing is, I do the haunted house voiceover for the person who runs the fictitious haunted house, the fictitious Lemp Mansion.
Oh, nice.
Which is
nice.
Just, you know, you slow my voice down a little bit and I talk a hell of a lot creepier and it sounds nothing like me. But it was just, it was interesting when I heard that chapter in your book, I was like, oh, this is just kind of a funny, weird coincidence. So when we're talking about you getting out there and doing this research on these locations, what were some of the most surprising things that you discovered while putting together Ghostland that you were unaware of prior to putting it together?
You know, I think there was the great thing about this book was there was a constant amount of sort of surprises and things that I just wasn't prepared for. And there were some places that I knew very well before I started, and there are other places that I just kind of thought, you know, well, I need a, you know, I want to do a haunted insane asylum because I think that's something that needs to be represented. So I would just sort of look around for, you know, haunted insane asylums and kind of pick one, you know, in some cases, I mean, you know, I want to make it sound like it was a random, but you know, there was an early period when I was just kind of sifting through stories left and right, looking for anything that might have been interesting, and I would find these things that were really great. I mean, perhaps the most surprising one was the Mustang Ranch in Nevada, mm-hmm. simply because I'd gone there for a completely different writing assignment. I'd been hired by Maxim magazine to profile the owner because he had been involved in a big deal with Tesla, the automotive company. And they thought, well, you know, here's a guy who owns a brothel and yet is doing stuff with Tesla. Why don't you go out and profile him? And I went out and I did this profile, and eventually they ended up, killing the story. So it never ran, but it was literally, I was there hanging out with the madam because the photographer they had sent was setting up some photo shoots of the place. And so I was just talking to the madam about, you know, Ghostland, which is the book I was working on at the time. And she said, you know, oh, you know, this place is haunted. And I, you know, it was just something I wasn't prepared for. And she got one of the other women who worked there to, you know, show me these videos on her phone that she had taken of these sort of paranormal things. And I, you know, talked to some of the other people about, you know, their experiences, and, you know, people seem to have experiences about it. And so I wasn't at all, I didn't go there with the intention of writing about it for Ghostland. I had just gone there for this other project, and I stumbled upon this haunting story, which turned out to be, you know, one of my more favorite chapters in the book, I think.
Mm-hmm. When you have a case like that and you have some evidence from one of the women who worked there on her phone with the orb and such, what's going through your mind? I mean, and this is just an opinion. I mean, feel free, you know, to use your judgment and express it on the program. I know you don't put it into the book super in detail, but I'm curious as to what you feel about things like that, where you have a lot of women that will, or anyone in any of these locations that will express, we believe this is haunted. Maybe it doesn't even line up with what the lore of the story is of X location, but we're having these experiences. Here's a little piece of evidence that we have. But what, when you have these, just so many people going through something, how are you processing all of that? How is it going through your mind in terms of, is this valid? Is there something else going on here with this person? Tell me what you're thinking.
Yeah, well, I mean, right. I mean, in the moment, my initial thought is I just want people to tell me the stories. Mm-hmm. You know, like I'm not, at that point, I'm not judging anything. I'm not, you know, I have no opinion whatsoever other than, you know, just a kind of wide-eyed tell me more. And again, you know, when I saw these, you know, when the madam at the brothel was first, you know, like, you know, well, you know, this woman, I think I called her Jean in the book, has these, has these videos, and I just thought, well, I want to see them, you know, and I didn't know what I was expecting. And, but I think of whenever anybody has a story to tell me, there's something that it just feels like a sort of gift that they're giving you, you know, that they are sort of like offering you this thing, you know, that's sort of personal and special to them. And I feel like it's my job to receive it as a gift, to receive it with, you know, kind of generosity and openness, because, you know, I feel like they don't have to share those stories, but, you know, they don't need to tell me that stuff. And so I, you know, if there are, you know, usually what happens is if it gets to the point where there's some kind of historical or, you know, verifiable aspect to the story, then I'll want to know, like, you know, does this check out at all? Can I, you know, verify this? And then, you know, from there, I try and sort of figure out, you know, well, you know, what does this mean? But I think that I still try and be open to what it means that, you know, this person is telling me a story. And again, I mean, you know, with the Mustang Ranch, I had gone there to just kind of understand the place. Full disclosure, I'd never been to a brothel before as a, you know, a reporter or a customer. So I had no idea about the world that I was in. Yeah. And, you know, and one of the things that it seemed very early on was that, it was just to say nothing of the physical aspect of the job, it's just a psychologically and emotionally difficult job.
Sure.
That I asked a group of women at one point of sort of over lunch, you know, how much of this job is sort of psychological, and they all said 100%, you know. And so it seemed to be a very difficult job emotionally to do for a person. And so when the madam was talking about these ghost stories, she said to me, one of the things she said to me was, you know, the women who see the ghosts most often are the ones who are having a difficult time. And I thought, well, that makes a certain kind of sense to me, in the sense that here's a very difficult, emotional, taxing job. And it is not, it's, you know, again, completely setting aside the physical requirements of a job like that, you know, that it's not for everybody emotionally, you know, and some women just aren't cut out for it. And I thought, you know, just sort of, you know, defaulting back to a kind of, I think in this moment, I kind of adopted a kind of almost 19th century, you know, model of sort of women's hysteria, you know, that women who were under emotional duress might act out in these ways. And I said something to that effect, you know, do you think that that's because this job is so, you know, psychologically difficult? And the madam just looked at me and she said, oh, no, I see the ghost too. You know, and it's, yeah. You know, so it kind of threw me for a loop in that moment. Just again, sort of thinking about how these stories come to me and what my job is in terms of reporting them and adjudicating them, I guess.
It's a really interesting case and a very interesting location, because you're exactly right. You have such an emotionally taxing job, where it would be very, very difficult, 100%, as they described it. It's 100%, you know, mental, and you're trying to deal with it emotionally, with what's going on and what you're doing. Is that, there's two ways of looking at that, and I'm curious as to, you know, after the fact, after obviously you've had some time to absorb this after all those experiences there, And I'm sure you've heard, you know, the ideas of individuals who are in, you know, not great places in their life, or they're in very difficult, mentally taxing situations, and it doesn't necessarily have to involve a brothel or legalized sure, prostitution. Right. Just someone who's going through something very difficult, whether it be disease, whether it be abuse, whether it be something very difficult going on in their family. I've heard thousands of stories on our other program over the last 8 years or so of people that there seems to be a correlation between being extremely emotionally taxed, and then almost like clockwork, you'll have paranormal activity pick up, things that are really truly not explainable happening to people in non-famous locations, just, you know, at 123, you know, Grove Street, whatever, just they're normal. There's nothing special about it. And they're not looking for attention. They're not looking to have a book written about it. They're just trying to feel normal and express those experiences that they've had, and then connect the dots of when I was in this very difficult time, these things seemed to happen. But then when more positivity came into my life, or I became more positive, whatever happened, and that atmosphere changed, those things seemed to slow down. Do you think there's a connection there where it's either something very much mental, where it's our brain and we get so taxed to a point where we can almost think we're experiencing paranormal things? Or do you think that people are more vulnerable to the world of the paranormal or supernatural or ghosts, whatever you'd like to call it, while they are, you know, being surrounded by more negativity, surrounded in kind of a place of, you know, ill repute, if you will?
Yeah, it's a great question. And again, I think it's a real Rorschach test. I think it is really, it's impossible, I think, to definitively answer that one way or another, because it would look the same either way. You know, I mean, whether or not, you know, that kind of emotional state precipitates a kind of delusion that takes the form of paranormal ghosts, or makes you more susceptible to go, you know, I mean, again, it's going to look the same either way. And so it doesn't seem to me, I think it's a really interesting question to kind of meditate on. And certainly I think it's sort of a case by case basis. Sometimes you can't help but kind of try and puzzle out what you think the answer is. But I think it's a little difficult to have a hard and fast rule without, again, kind of backing yourself into a corner where you're either arguing with skeptics that ghosts are real, or you're arguing with believers that ghosts are false. And either one of those, I think, is just kind of it becomes a circular conversation really quickly. And it just kind of loses interest for me, I guess.
That wraps up the first part of our conversation with Colin Dickey, author of Ghostland, An American History in Haunted Places, available wherever books are sold. In part two of our conversation, we'll ask Colin, are there certain locations that seem to have more ghostly lore around them than others? Asylums. They're some of the most infamous haunted locations dotted all over our country and the world. What did he find there? Does Colin believe that a location can be haunted by the energy of what once happened there, but not necessarily the actual spirits of the deceased? And was there any location that Colin investigated that he believes to be much more haunted than others? We'll talk about that and more in part two of our conversation. To hear it, become a Gravekeeper. That's a supporter of our program. Go to thegravetalks.com and click Become a Gravekeeper, or patreon.com/thegravetalks. Sign up for $5 a month to get access to all of our interviews, hundreds of them in their entirety, and keep our program on the air. Or you can sign up annually and get 1 month free. patreon.com/thegravetalks to sign up. Until next time, for The Grave Talks, I'm Tony Bruschi. Thanks for listening.